Hi, and welcome to the Edible Community Show. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, and we're here today, our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Thanks to them, we're here on the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm very excited about today's show. I have some wonderful guests that are really going to get you into the holiday spirit, just like I'm sure that wonderful music just did. And before we break and bring on our guests that are here with me in the studio, I wanted to just do a little shout-out, as my friends at Heritage Ranch, at Heritage Radio like to call it, and do a little shout-out to Courtney Kontos. Courtney is a wonderful chef here in Vermont, and she's a culinary coach. She's doing a really fun cookie blog every day of December, and I'm really impressed with her ambition to come up with 30 days worth of cookies, and they're all terrific, or 31, I think, if it's every day of December. And you can find her at chefkontos.blogspot.com, and that would be chefkontos.blogspot.com. So make sure that you check out Chef Kontos's cookies. They're all terrific, and I know they'll be great. So today I've got two wonderful people here with me, Eleanor Legere. She is the founder, along with her husband, Albert, of Eden Ice Cider, and they're based in West Charleston, Vermont. And Neil Johnston, who is the general manager and a partner of the Kitchen Table Bistro. And you've probably heard about the Kitchen Table. If you're into food and into the James Beard Awards, you know that Steve and Laura Atkins, who are the chef owners of that restaurant, were nominated this year and are real leaders in New England in the whole farm-to-table movement. So we've got them both here, and we're going to learn a lot of great things about ice cider. I have a feeling you're all going to be getting bottles of this to celebrate your holidays and for toasting the new year. It's a great alternative to champagne. And what we plan to do is tell you a little bit about where it comes from, how it's made, and then we're going to do some tasting, and we'll tell you how you can find some of these apples that we're trying near you and how you can get your own bottle for the holidays. So let's take a short break, and I'll come back with Eleanor and Neil. We're here on the Heritage Radio Network, thanks to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. And our topic today is ice cider. And a little beyond that, we're talking about locally produced wonderful artisanal foods. And then we also are going to talk about how they find their way into restaurants and also how they find their way into your homes. So my guests are Eleanor Legere. She and her husband, as I mentioned, Albert, are the founders of Eden Ice Cider. And what really distinguishes Eden is that they are the first, the very first, to produce this product in the United States. And when you start to think about what that means in terms of wine and beer and all the folks who were the pioneers of these types of products, that's really where they are in the ice cider movement. And so you'll learn from Eleanor that it's a very popular drink in Quebec and in other parts of the world. In a way, right? We've got some other things. I'm looking at her for some acknowledgement there. But she'll tell you a little bit about it and how it fits. And then Neil is here to give us his perspective on, he's got an incredible palate and so much knowledge about food and how to put things together and what people are really interested in and what appeals to them. And so he's going to give us that perspective. So first I want to start by saying hello. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for being here on this not too chilly Vermont evening. And I got to start with Eleanor. And Eleanor, I want you to tell us a little bit about how you get into this, because you know, coming to Vermont, we meet a lot of people who've had other lives. Neil and Eleanor have both had other careers, very robust other lives. And somehow, at a certain time, you decided, this is the moment when I'm going to make this happen. So how does someone just leave what we think of as a more traditional life and become a farmer?
Well, I think for my husband and Albert and myself, it's something we've dreamed about always from early days of when we were first married and thinking about building our lives together, but as many of us often do, you fall into the pattern of what you're in then, what seems like the logical next step, and all of a sudden we found ourselves 20 years later saying, gee, you know, we both had this dream of having a farm in Vermont and growing apples and making something wonderful from them, and Albert had the chance to start teaching chemistry at a boarding school, which allowed us to move on to on-campus housing and sell a house in Connecticut, and that, you know, let us sort of look, we looked at each other in the eye and said, well, if we're ever going to follow our dream and buy a farm, this is the time and we could do it. So we had a drink of something. And
it was nice cider
at the time and said, we've got to do it.
And why apples? Why did apples appeal to you in particular?
Well, we love apples. We've always loved apples. We've been to Normandy and tasted the cider there and Calvados and things like that. And for a while we were trying to run. My background is you know, general management, business and strategy, and product marketing. And we'd run a lot of business models on hard cider and on apple brandy. And we're finding it kind of hard to figure out how we were going to make it work. And then since Albert is from Canada, he's French-Canadian, most of his family's in Montreal, we were there and tasted iced cider and had that moment when we looked at each other and said, this is what we're going to make.
So the light bulb went off.
The light bulb
went off.
It
was one of those aha moments.
Mm-hmm.
And then why don't you just give us a sense of when you began? That was how many years ago? Wasn't that long ago?
We bought the farm in 2007, so we're just coming up on our third year. Yeah.
And you've gone from your first season, you had hundreds of bottles, to now pretty much thousands of bottles.
That's right. That's right. We made 100 cases the first year just, A, to see if we could make something that tasted at all good, and then to see, even if it was good, would anybody actually be interested in buying it. And Neil was actually one of our very first customers.
Absolutely.
And that's a great segue to Neil. So, Neil, you also have a very exciting background that I think has brought a lot to what you're doing today.
I think so. I was born in England, but grew up between England and Canada for most of my early, up until I was 17 years old, and then landed back in England. After going through electrical engineering at college, realized that it was not really anything I was interested in, and somebody suggested the travel industry to me. And I went into the travel industry and did that for about 12 years at various levels with groups and tours, and ended up in the city of London doing corporate travel for a number of major banks. But I kind of think the whole hospitality, restaurant, where I'm at now, kind of started from a single day trip to France from Dover to Calais, going over and having lunch in France and going into this restaurant and sitting down and somebody bringing us food, which was mussels marinière and a bottle of muscadet.
Your first pairing experience.
Yeah, my first, like, wow, these were just meant to be together. And I still remember it to this day, and frequented France and Spain, and I've traveled quite extensively during that time. After that, I kind of moved back to Canada in my late 20s and decided that maybe I should really try to get into the food business. I was interested in hotels, but actually more interested in becoming a cook or a chef at that point, and went to culinary school. I went through the process of culinary school, worked in some hotels and restaurants in Vancouver, then ended up in Los Angeles, where I realized that I was never going to be a star in the chef side of things, but at that point, moved to the front of the house and started to learn the management and the sommelier side of things, and really kind of utilized some of my skills there. And my result of ending up in Vermont was hiring my wife in a restaurant called Melisse in Los Angeles that I was working at. And we ended up coming to Vermont. I'd been here once before with her, but I didn't really know what I was coming to other than a scenario of this would be a great place for us to raise a family.
Well, and you both have a very interesting situation. I thought about this. You both have a partner from this part of the world, essentially. I mean, that brought you in some way here, which I just find that interesting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Vermont seems to be the ideal place for both of you to be what you're doing.
I'd love to talk more about that. I think Vermont was attractive to us initially when I said, you know, we'd had this dream for a long time. My father's family is from the Northeast Kingdom going back generations. So I'd grown up sort of coming here to go to funerals and go skiing and things like that.
The whole catastrophe.
Right.
Is that okay?
But I think what has happened over the past number of years is, you know, that was sort of, we love this area and it's beautiful and we know about it. And we would like to be there because we have these ties. But the other thing is it's so attractive as a place to start a food-based business because the community, the knowledge in the community is so high, the interest and the support is so high. I can't imagine if we had started Ice Cider even in New Hampshire, it wouldn't have been the same. So I think there's something very special about Vermont that, you know, we may have come here partly for other reasons, but... Boy, am I glad this is where we are.
Absolutely.
Get going.
Absolutely.
Well, and I think, Neil, the restaurant, you know, that you're in is really defined by that. Steve and Laura have a Vermont connection also. And
Steve grew up in this area, and Shelburne was from Shelburne. And after they spent some time out in California kind of honing their skills, decided that they really wanted to raise their family here and came back to Vermont and found the old, 1795 Chittenden home was up for sale when they came back and went through some major renovations of that, and that became, you know, what is now the kitchen table in its seventh year or 7 years come February. But as Eleanor says, it really is an area that allows you to expand on the food movement, on the local production of food. So much is done for us on a daily basis by people arriving at our back door, you know, from Half Pint Farms in the Intervale bringing us all this fabulous produce, to the foragers turning up with mushrooms galore, to, you know, Boyden Farms turning up with their meat. And, you know, things have slightly changed as things have grown, and it's maybe not as personal as it used to be, but that's because there's more production going on now. There's more sourcing. There's more people who are interested in it. Even Eleanor's just experienced, you know, when I first met Eleanor, she was delivering stuff by herself. To the door, you know, walking into the restaurant and bringing me the product.
Right.
She's now represented by G Housing.
Right.
You know, things change. Things evolve.
Well, and what do you think it is about our climate? I want to spend, I mean, later in the show, and I hope everybody listening sticks around, because we're going to get into some actual tasting and take advantage. Both these folks have great palates, and I know I'm eager to have them help me learn how to articulate some things and what words to use to describe things we're tasting. But I think it's important that we get a sense of why here and what it is about this place, because I'm also hoping that people who live in places other than Vermont can find within their communities things they can do to create this kind of movement, as we've been calling it. So what was it? I know, Eleanor, you feel that our Agency of Agriculture is very supportive. What are some of the other factors?
Well, I think...
Or expand on that for a minute, if you want.
Yeah, I know now is the time also to just talk a little bit about Ice Cider, what it is, and why Vermont is such a great place to do it.
Maybe we should, because a lot of folks may not know that we're not talking about hard cider.
Right. It's a hard cider in the sense that it's an alcoholic beverage made from apples, but it's technically a dessert wine. It's 10% alcohol, and it's made by freezing cider outside in the cold weather that we have. So we're right in the middle of pressing apples right now, and the temperatures have gotten nice and cold up in the Northeast Kingdom. So we have large containers of freshly pressed juice of all these different wonderful apples that are outside freezing in our barn. And then in about 6 weeks, we'll bring them back into the winery. And the first 20 to 25% that melts off is all the sugar and the flavor of the fruit. And the rest stays back as ice. So we got concentrated apple goodness that comes out first is what we ferment into the wine.
And how many, is it fair to ask how many apples go into a bottle? Would you guess?
It's over 8 pounds of apples in every to make one bottle.
Of cider.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a
it's
lot
a very
of apples.
Concentrated flavor. But it's yeah. the reason that Vermont is so perfect is and really why this was developed in Quebec, right across the border in the eastern townships, is you've got to have a climate that's warm enough to grow apples. We've grown apples in Vermont
forever,
centuries.
Right?
And we have wonderful varieties of apples that are grown here, not just sort of the commercial ones you find in an average big chain grocery store. But at the same time, you have to have long enough periods of natural cold in the winter to be able to do this. The Quebec government has done a great job of creating a regulatory definition of ice cider. So if you want to have a label approved by the U.S. government for ice cider, you have to conform to the Quebec regulations of using natural cold.
Interesting.
While there are some people who I know of who make something like this, they're doing it in a freezer, producing it all year round,
right.
And it's not quite the same thing.
And what do they call it?
They can call it various sort of things like ice harvest apple cider or
so it's sort of like champagne,
wine, but they can't use that label across state lines. They can use it within their state.
So it is a little like champagne. You know how champagne, can only call it champagne if it's made in that method?
That's more a method, but the champagne is more the name of the region.
Uh-huh.
So the sparkling wine comes from champagne, as Sauvignon Blanc comes from Sancerre.
Okay. Okay.
Chenin Blanc comes from Vouvray, but the method champenoise is very specific,
which would relate to
the specific
that
method.
Kind
yeah.
of thing. Interesting.
What it's really close to is the definition of ice wines.
Yeah.
And that was a World Trade Organization suit and settlement across lots of international boundaries where the Canadians were saying if you want to call it ice wine, you have to have the grapes freeze naturally.
Freeze naturally, absolutely. Huh. And they're picked in like late December. Things like Enniskillen Ice Wines and from Ontario, they're all picked absolutely off the vine.
Frozen solid.
No exceptions. So that's the definition of the ice wine.
And there are a few ice ciders that are made from apples that have remained on trees. But apples are different from grapes, and the vast majority of them tend to fall off when they're ripe.
Yeah.
And therefore, the name ice cider is particularly appropriate because we freeze the cider, not the apple.
Right, which a lot of people, though, I've been with you when people have asked you about the, and I've dined with people when we've ordered it, and a lot of people do misunderstand that, and they think that the apples are frozen and don't realize it's the cider that's frozen.
That's why we produce a beautiful little leaflet that has all the information on it. Apple at its most refined, and I completely believe that is, but people are so interested in learning the process.
Yeah,
and
I think
so many
true.
People have never even heard of this. I myself, as you know, I consider myself quite familiar with beverages of the world.
Yes, I think we all agree.
I had never even heard of anything like this, even from Quebec. The
Wow! Until you had met Eleanor when she brought it in.
Until she walked through that door.
Isn't that exciting?
And, yeah, I just remember her coming in the first day 2 years ago. We'd be going into the third vintage right now, but 2 years ago coming in and opening up, I got some ice cider for you. Oh, really? You know? And we opened it up, and I could not believe it. It was the mouthfeel, the flavors was just so...
So now
so refined.
Hold that.
It's so amazing.
Well, we're going to get to that.
It's a unique product.
Yeah,
never heard
it
of it before. And
it
just made me, I mean, I bought it right on the spot.
But one last thing, I couldn't have walked in that door if you hadn't been a member of the Vermont Fresh Network and oriented toward local foods. Because if I had called up and said, I'm from, you know, so-and-so Maine or so-and-so Maryland, you wouldn't have had time in your schedule. You wouldn't have made time
in
your schedule.
Yeah, it would have to be something quite special to appeal from outside of the state.
But I can call up Neil and a couple of other places and say, I'm here in Vermont, I'm making this product, I'd just like to come and give you a taste, could I please spare a few minutes for me?
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, you're in Vermont? Absolutely, come on by.
It's the same with stuff we source at the restaurant. If there's something that's coming from, you know, New Hampshire or Massachusetts, and we can get the same thing here in Vermont,
You'll prioritize from us.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's one
quality
thing.
Quality driven, of course.
Pardon me. Quality driven. Absolutely. And I do want to get back to the support of the community, but I think this does tie in. And I sometimes wonder when folks are listening to us who aren't here if we're sounding a little Vermont centric. But I think the lesson to take from our conversation is that we've really built a community here that supports one another in doing this and in prioritizing one another. And that's one reason why it works.
Absolutely.
It's because folks know that if I grow it here and if I grow it of quality, I'll get the priority, and then at least within my environment, it'll get selected or chosen.
Yeah.
And Vermont Fresh Network is a, there's VermontFreshNetwork.net, I believe.
VermontFresh.net, yeah.
VermontFresh.net. And that's a great place for folks to go if they want to know about what's going on in Vermont and some ideas of Vermont products in other places. But I want to get back to Eleanor telling us a little about the support you've had from the bigger spectrum, too, not just the foodie community.
Which has been fabulous. But also, I think a number of people have gotten excited about ice cider as something that makes sense to be made here in Vermont. And you can believe that the best ice cider in the world could come from Vermont because we've got the apples and we've got the cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Agency of Agriculture has been very supportive in helping to get a grant from the USDA to help develop the cider and ice cider industry in Vermont. And we've had a UK expert come and give a course on making hard cider and ice cider so that people who are in orchards in Vermont can add this value-added product to what they do with their apples. It's very hard in the commercial apple business now for anybody in Vermont to sell their apples other than the pick-your-owns and the things. So value-added products are really important. And there's been great interest. We had 26 people in the course, including, people who run orchards.
Yep.
That's great.
And we all took a trip up to Quebec on December 1st to visit some of the ice cider makers there. So I know of there are going to be at least four other ice ciders produced
starting
this winter.
That's amazing.
Which is great.
I can see this becoming as popular as the Vermont cheese movement is.
Well, and I was just going
There's
to
no
say...
There's no reason why it should not.
It's interesting.
We have plenty of products.
Yeah.
I mean, look at all the, orchards, excuse me.
Right.
Those apple places. Look at all the orchards. I mean, there's just no reason why,
Well, and
I've tasted a lot since trying Eleanor's product first. I've now sourced out some other things in Quebec and tasting. I'm doing comparisons and seeing as I would for tasting all the Vermont cheeses compared to what comes out of France,
Right.
And they're absolutely equal, if not better quality.
Right.
And probably better quality just in my own mind because they're just so local.
Right. They don't travel
and
they're right here.
You can, as I like to say with Steve and how we do things, you can taste the seasons on these things. You really can.
It's a great phrase.
It's very, everything's very tangible. It's right here. It's really, it's alive,
Yeah.
Really
it
alive.
It is very alive. Well, and I think, as you just said that about value added for apples, because, I think that's a lot of why our cheese movement is so powerful, right? They needed value added for the dairy industry.
Yeah.
And now that same innovative thinking is what's going on.
Right.
So
it's not just ice cider. It is hard cider. People are getting more interested in that. And also apple brandy. Nick calls it
Shelburne Orchards.
Getting
a
distiller's license. And
we actually talked about Shelburne Orchards a few shows back, so people might remember that. I think this might be a good time for us to take a break. I'm sure you're all getting thirsty out there just thinking about this incredible ice cider. So we'll take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the apples that we use to make the cider, and Neil's going to help us with some language and tasting and pairing, and Eleanor's also brought some of that incredible Vermont cheese. And those of you who listen to Heritage Radio Network know Ann Saxelby, and she's a great source for finding cheese in New York. And the cheeses that we're going to taste here, I'm sure she can find you, so we'll make sure that we give you some specifics about what we're having. So thanks a lot. Let's take a short break, and we'll come right back.
Quiet talks of quiet dreams and the window that looks up on the mountains and the sea. Oh, how lovely is where I wanna be, here with you so close to me. Until the final flicker of life's embers, I was lost and lonely, believing life was only a bitter tragic joke I found with you.
So welcome back to the Edible Community Show. If you've been listening, you know we're talking about ice cider with my guests Eleanor Legere and Neil Johnston, who's from the Kitchen Table Bistro. And this is the part of the show I've been looking forward to even more than all the rest of it, because we're going to start tasting some apples and getting even more specific about the process of how to make cider and how to taste. And Neil's such an expert at these pairings, and as you heard, he can still remember that first taste of mussels and
muscadet
and what that did for him. And there is something about, you know, we've all heard about slow food and the slow food movement, and I think that something really positive that's grown out of that is more consciousness about how things taste and how we're tasting them. So we're now going to enter a little bit of a slow food moment in the show, and I'm excited about that. So let me just remind you that our sponsor today is Hearst Ranch, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. So, Eleanor, what do you have there? There's some beautiful apples here, folks. And if you want to see pictures, I'll make sure I spell out the names so you can look them up online or something.
Right. One of the benefits we have is working with two wonderful Vermont orchards, to whom I would like to give a little shout out.
Absolutely.
One of which is Champlain Orchards, which gives us the McIntosh apple, which is, of course, a classic northern apple, and also Empire and Honeycrisp. And we'll talk a little bit more about Honeycrisp, and I have one of those here today. And then Scott Farm down near Brattleboro, which Zeke Goodband, who's the orchardist there, is, I think, like to think of him as like a museum curator of apple varieties, and they have all kinds of antique and heirloom and cider varieties of apples. So if you were here, you would see I've got seven apples here, and I think only one of them looks like something you might typically find in a grocery store. The others range in size from maybe 2 inches, little brown, round, almost like a little rock, to almost 5 inches or 6 inches in diameter.
Right.
This very
bigger
large
than a
one.
Softball, for sure.
Yeah. Yep, and there's a beautiful yellow apple here, quite large with very pronounced ribs on it, and a pink flush, a very distinctive-looking
wow.
apple.
It's beautiful.
What is that?
That is the Calville Blanc d'Hiver.
Really?
Which is what we named our product after last year. It's a very famous French culinary apple. It's been around, known for 400 years. It was Monet's favorite apple. There's a wonderful still-life painting in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris where you can recognize the apple in the still-life. And it has more vitamin C than an orange, which provides some of that acidity, that bright acidity,
really,
to balance the sweetness and the
cider. And could you spell that? Because I promised folks they could look
yes.
this up.
So if you search Calville, which is Calville, Blanc, Blanc,
white in French.
Yes. Okay. Then that will, an apple. That
right.
Will
that will help you
it.
Find it. And
yep.
For those of you who aren't seeing it, what's really interesting about the ribs is it almost, it has the shape of an apple, but the rib part of it is almost like a pepper,
mm-hmm.
right? It's
yeah.
almost like you'd imagine a red pepper
right.
or green pepper
yeah.
or
pumpkin-like.
Yeah, or pumpkin-like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting
very pronounced
to see
shoulders.
Yeah, very,
how that
yeah.
tastes. If I could ask you for a moment to tell us a little bit about the difference between an antique apple, an heirloom apple, a cider apple.
Yes, that's a great thing to explore. So many people don't realize that apples are what's called heterozygous, which means they cross-pollinate to produce their fruit. So if you take a seed of a McIntosh apple and plant it, you are not likely to get a McIntosh apple when it grows. So the only way that you propagate a variety consistently over time is through grafting budwood from an existing tree onto a rootstock. So something like a Roxbury russet, which is an heirloom
which
apple,
looks like a potato,
which
on the
looks like a little brown frosting. This was an apple that was discovered in Roxbury, Massachusetts in the early 1600s, 1640s, 1647, some say, who knows for sure. So somebody has been continually propagating this variety in
wow.
America for almost 400 years.
And our friends at Heritage Foods love hearing this because, you know, Heritage Foods, who are the folks who started the Heritage Radio Network, they're all about heirloom and bringing back this type of thing.
Right.
So this is such a great opportunity to be letting our listeners know that this is going on in, you know, in some great places around
right.
the country.
And cider apples were basically the most common apples that were grown here up until Prohibition. What everybody drank was not wine, not beer so much, but hard cider. Mm-hmm. Johnny Appleseed went all over the place.
Right.
Sprinkling apple seeds. There was a great explosion in the natural diversity of apple varieties because it was through seed, right? So they're cross-pollinated.
So they
Everyone's kind of different.
What were they like? Were they like what we think of today?
And cider apples are things you would not necessarily care to eat out of hand. They can be very bitter.
Oh.
They can be very hard, very woody. They have a lot of tannins in them sometimes. Every once in a while, there's some sweet ones. Russets, like this heirloom russet, is
right.
a very sweet apple. The Roxbury russet that we talked about earlier has the highest level of sugar of the apples that we use for our ice cider. So basically, everybody had a couple of trees in their backyard. They might have one that was good for making pies, which maybe had some acidity to keep it.
And would hold its shape a little better.
And not brown so much, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd have a bunch that were they would just put into the, you know, press them, drink the sweet cider, and then it would turn fizzy and alcoholic, and they'd drink that. And, of course, a lot of the old-timers that come up to me at the farmer's market say, oh, you must make Applejack because you're freezing it. And that's different. I should explain because a lot of people
explain Applejack.
The old-time, the old-time Applejack was you'd press your cider, you'd put it in a barrel, you'd put it in the barn. It would ferment to dry, so there'd be no sugar left in it, no sweetness left in it.
Uh-huh.
And then the winter would come, and it would freeze, and they'd crack into it and get some of the liquid out, and basically it would concentrate the alcohol.
Oh.
So you get a very dangerous, not terribly good-tasting beverage, but it met the needs of that particular interest.
Wow.
So it's
very interesting.
Ice cider is just the reverse.
Yes.
Right? We freeze first to concentrate the sugars, and then we ferment only partially, so you have a good balance of alcohol, sugar, and acidity.
And do apples grow in all 50 states?
That's a good question. I actually don't know. I'm very focused on New England and the varieties that we've had here.
Well, I mean, I know Washington State, you know, has a big apple industry.
Virginia has lots of apples. I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't see why not.
Yeah, I mean,
I would think they could.
Because of the genetic diversity, I'm sure
that there's an apple grown everywhere.
Yeah. I would be shocked if there weren't. Yeah.
So how would you suggest, Neil, you're our expert with tasting here. What is one supposed to taste from because we have, what, five tastes? Sour, bitter, salty, sweet, and umami, as Eleanor and I learned not long ago. Where do you begin when you're trying to taste something like we're talking about today, a variety of something?
Well, I treat almost every beverage that I partake in as I always start with smelling the item.
First with smell. And what are you looking for when you smell?
Well,
what's
the
happening?
Smell that it's a pleasurable smell. You know, it's pretty well the same way you go about wine tasting.
Because
first you're smelling it to ensure that the product's not faulty or corked or oxidized in any way. Corked, you know, gives off a very negative aroma. Oxidization can be a visual thing, but also you can pick up some mustiness on that. And just really the, you know, I think the first thing that we do instead of the nose is such an important sense as far as food and wine goes that, you know, there's just so much going on there. It's always the first thing to do, and it makes sense to me just to, you know.
To smell.
Whatever it is. It's like I'm just ready to pick up these apples and smell them
and we'll
for what
start
they
with
are.
That. So, Eleanor, what are you going to give us first?
So, I brought two ice ciders, our main product, Eden, but then I brought an unlabeled bottle of Honeycrisp, which was a test batch last year. We're going to make this product this winter. People may know the Honeycrisp apple. It's not an heirloom. It's a relatively new variety out of Minnesota, the breeding apple variety breeding program there, and it is cold hardy. It's an apple for the north, It's a wonderful crisp and a quite distinctive flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought
Neil's going to taste. Taste the apple. So
and
he's
then
gonna smell
taste
and
the ice cider made from the Honeycrisp.
Okay.
And see if you can taste.
So what
the
did
same
you smell,
taste.
Neil, when you smell that Honeycrisp?
Very light.
Very light.
It's a very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the apple comes through there, but
is there a lot of honey?
Not really.
No.
In this process, there's a very much subtlety to the apple.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it smells very apple-y to me.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you go through the process of making the cider, that's when you're really bringing out. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like reducing a sauce. You're
right.
You're going to intensify the flavors. You know,
but it
you get
very,
honey and pear and citrus and,
So, folks, if you and you know, one nice thing about apples for those of us in New England, it's one of the only fruits we can get in Vermont. And usually, what through March? March it gets a little chancy,
mm-hmm.
but the Honeycrisp is a great keeping apple.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
yep. I found this Honeycrisp in the store today,
General Grocery Store.
So,
yeah.
And I would imagine you could find it pretty much throughout New England. It is becoming a very popular.
It has
apple.
Become really popular.
Yeah.
I think because, you know, people like the crunchy,
yep.
and it stays crunchy. It doesn't get mealy. So I guess, now, how many, we know it takes about 8 pounds of Honeycrisp apples to make
mm-hmm.
one bottle of this
mm-hmm.
wonderful cider. And you're getting your, I know you've started an orchard, which will take you a while before you can get your own.
That's right.
So partnership-wise, how has this had an impact on the orchards that you're working with? I would think going from a few hundred cases to thousands and wanting to source locally has made a difference.
A couple of hundred bottles, too.
It's a projected 18,000 next year.
Next year, we hope, yes.
18,000 bottles?
Yes, we're making this winter.
Wow,
yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yep. Still very small by wine industry standards.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so what when you say that, I'm just curious, wine industry standards, what?
So you are considered a very small artisanal producer if you make 2,000 gallons of wine or less.
And
the way that the excise tax system works, you pay the minimum tax below that, and then it gradually increases, and a large-scale winery would be can be as much as 200,000 gallons. And then you've got the huge bulk producers, which are millions.
Enormous, right. So you're still considered, you're still in the artisanal, very small.
Yes.
So now if we're going to, so tell me a little about what's going on with the orchards in the area that you're sourcing from, and how you've had an impact on them.
Scott Farm and Champlain Orchards. Well, I consider they've had much more of an impact on me than I have on them at this point. I mean, they've been wonderful partners to work with, and I think we're very loyal to each other. And I don't know.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, I mean, because when you started, they had what you needed, right? It takes an apple tree how many years? 3 years before you can really pick a fruit?
Right. The old-time standard apple trees that were 25 feet tall took 10 years to get
to
going.
To mature,
yeah. To get going. The new...
What were they doing with that fruit before they were giving it to you?
Bill at Champlain Orchards makes wonderful sweet cider that you can find in a... All over the state. And Scott Farm has been, you can find their apples now in the co-ops in Montpelier and here in Healthy Living.
Yeah, they're
and so
a little
forth.
Bit
yeah.
more southern, but they're getting distribution everywhere.
But we do get utility-grade apples, so they may be apples that that people weren't able to sell in the commercial market or didn't have customers for cider.
Which is another, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's another wonderful thing about this product. I mean, the idea that those are apples that, as you said, were utility grade, which doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them, right? But we're so accustomed now as a consumer, you know, what we've had happen in the stores is that we expect everything to look perfect. There can't be a blemish on the fruit,
Which is something that I kind of came from that background a little bit.
I think we all do.
Living in California. And
yeah.
Seeing all the perfect tomatoes and the perfect apples and the perfect produce and coming here kind of really made me more aware of that, especially when it came to the tomatoes and the apples.
Mm-hmm.
You know, heirloom tomatoes are probably
ugly. Well, they're beautiful.
See, I think they're beautiful.
They're beautiful. They're beautiful, but they're
as are these apples. When I sit and look at these apples, these are
the
these
diversity
are gorgeous
is
too.
Fantastic.
You know, I don't particularly want to sit and look at a perfect Macintosh anymore.
I'm looking for
these interesting alternatives like this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know the flavors that can come from these fruits are unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, there's a reason why, you know, at the kitchen table we do a tomato dinner and an apple dinner.
Right. And I'm glad you're bringing that up.
Which is something that's amazing.
And they're wonderful dinners.
Yeah.
They are.
They're unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, right now we're using maybe 6 or 7 different kinds of apples at the restaurant right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have Laura Atkins, who's our pastry chef. She uses... I forget the varietal. She'll kill me for not knowing it. But she makes her grandmother's apple cake.
Oh, it's such a great recipe.
Which is something that we pair with this Vermont iced cider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We should have had you bring it.
served warm, though, so, you know.
That might have been
part
hard.
Of the issue there. But it's just something that, you know, and similarly with the tomatoes that come out during the course of the year, there can be 25 to 50 different kinds of heirloom tomatoes that are just exotic colors and flavors and different nuances to them, and same with the apples, you know.
Right.
It's just so interesting. Yeah.
Well, and we should mention, I mean, that apple dinner and the tomato dinner, if people want a great excuse to come to Vermont during those times of year, I'll be giving websites certainly at the end again, but thekitchentablebistro.com, you need the T-H-E there, but thekitchentablebistro.com. You can get on their newsletter. You'll get their newsletter, and you'll know when these dinners are happening. And it really is a worthy destination place, as is Eden Orchard. So you could always email me at Deborah@ediblegreenmountains.com, and I can give you some ideas for how to visit these guys when you come to Vermont. So now we're going to taste this delicious elixir in front of us. And Neil, why don't you guide us through how to do that? So imagine, folks, you've got a glass of this in front of you.
This is the Honeycrisp made from this.
So we've just tasted the apple. And you might want to do this with, could someone do this with grapes? Could they go, you know, have a wine and find a Pinot grape or something?
No.
Can't do it the same way with grapes.
No.
Doesn't work the same way.
The vinification process really changes the makeup of grapes. This is far more, Eden iced cider is far more of a natural process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything is always ultimately in the hands of the winemaker or cider maker, but, you know, we've talked about this before. They've very much let the apples and nature do the talking here.
That's really true. You're not doing...
There's no added sugars, you know. It's an au naturel process.
Right.
It really is.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah, it really is.
And when you think that it can work that way.
Yeah.
And we control the profile of the product by the blending of the different apples. Right, so we do have apples that are very sweet. We have apples that have quite a bit of acidity, apples that have quite a bit of natural tannin in them.
So when you say the profile, is the goal so that if somebody has a bottle of your cider this year and then they have a bottle next year, is the idea for it to taste similar? Or?
Someday we hope to get to the point where we have that consistency.
Yeah.
So that is a goal, even though you want to have a natural process. How is that possible?
Yes, well, it would be much easier if we just took a bunch of apples, threw them in a press, put the juice outside to freeze, and then just made the wine, put some yeast in, and let it happen. But what we do is we press each different variety separately, freeze them separately, take the concentrate, ferment them separately, and blend at the end, looking for the right balance of sweetness, acidity, tannins, and alcohol, so that it is a good balance.
And is that traditionally how it's been done, and you've adapted that, or did you sort of design that process?
I can't speak for the Quebec cider makers, ice cider makers. We're only in our third year, and part of the reason we do it that way is that we're still learning, and we're trying to understand how a Roxbury, what kind of an ice cider a Roxbury russet makes, and how that adds to the blend versus an Ashmead's Kernel, which is a classic British cider apple.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is where that science background that your husband has really helps, right? Both of you bringing that in mind. So we've been teasing you guys about the taste. So Neil, you sniffed for the aroma.
I drank all mine.
You drank all yours. You're going to need a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful sweet aroma.
It's a little lighter style, I think, than the Calville blend.
This is the single varietal. So just Honeycrisp. So it would be, in the wine world, this would be similar to a single varietal. What, like a Pinot? Is that all Pinot grapes?
Yeah, Pinot Noir. Any particular varietal of grape is classified as a single varietal. But I think, you know, this one, Eleanor has this one here, and then she has a Northern Spy one, which they put back to
stay in the barrel for a little bit longer,
you know, which will help
evolve a little bit.
We're
trying oak aging for the first time.
Yeah. So. Oh, exciting.
Yeah. Oak aging is coming to Vermont, not just in the ice cider business, but in the wine business too? Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
There's been a lot of stainless steel fermentation going on here, which to me doesn't add a lot of character to some of the difficult varietals that we have here to work with as far as on the wine side of things. But just with what Eleanor is doing with this Northern Spy, I can't wait to taste that one. I think that is just going to be mind-blowing as far as
now it has to be.
Well, how would that
be different than what we're tasting with the Honeycrisp?
It's going to be a darker in color. It's going to you get flavor from the oak. Oak barrels are there's so many variances of oak barrels depending on where you're buying them from. France, Hungary, American oak. You know, it depends what it comes from, but it's also the level of toast on a barrel. The darkness.
Toast.
The char would be the inside of the barrel.
Okay.
So you get different kinds of flavors when using different levels of char and different types of oak and stuff. And it's just so, there's so many little nuances. They're only into their third vintage of this. So Albert has so many options available to him.
Right.
You know, the first time I ever tasted the first release of the Eden Ice Cider, I was just blown away. It was unctuous without being cloyingly sweet. It was just so delicious. It had great acidity. You know, to me, a good product has a really nice nose. You can smell what's going on, but it has a beginning, a middle, and a finish. And this product had that.
That's nice. A beginning,
this product
a middle,
this year,
and
the Cowboy Blend too, is a little lighter in style, but it still has all those components. Like I say, the Northern Spy one, that which will come out.
You think
they'll
knock your
they're ready
off.
To. Yeah.
And how do you determine what barrel to use with all those options?
Well, somebody asked me at a tasting in New York with Garrett Oliver, and one of the attendees said, "So are you doing experiments with oak? You know, different types of barrels?" I said, "We have one barrel."
Bottles will come out of your barrel?
Oh, it will be a few hundred.
One get a, quote, used barrel? A previously owned barrel?
Right. It's a French oak barrel, and it was used to make Chardonnay twice, so it will have the barrel won't impart its previous contents into our ice cider, and partly that because of the used oak, it doesn't put a whole bunch of oakiness into it right away, which is why we ended up deciding to leave it in for a year.
Right. Older oak imparts less flavor.
Right. I see.
Or over time you get more of that. So it will add some spiciness, it will add a little sort of butteriness, and it will take a single varietal from a Northern Spy apple, which has a good flavor profile to begin with, but it will make it more complex, and then you have the sort of micro-oxidation that happens in a barrel as well. So, you know, it's going to be something different.
So now all this language, you know, because there's a lot of language that goes on with all this tasting, and those of you who know me and these guys know me, my husband's not a big wine person. You know, he would be one of the people sitting here going, it either sort of tastes good or bad, you know.
Right.
So what is the benefit of getting to where you begin to be able to describe your food in this way or taste it in this way? Why go to the trouble?
I think because at the end of the day, the only thing that matters is whether you think it's good or bad. And we use all this language because we're trying to figure out how to make something good. And there's so many different components of it that in order to come up with something good, we have to sort of analyze it and decompose it and figure out what to do with the different things. But at the end of the day, all we care about is that your husband
that
Lou thinks it's good.
Right.
I don't want it. He shouldn't have to know all this arcane whatever.
Why it's
right.
good. Just
yeah.
that
yeah,
it's
just good.
That
it's good.
And then there's the school of people, though, or the whole world of people. And I find it fascinating. I love being able to describe it. And should we try the other and see how it compares? So the one we just had, the Honeycrisp. Now, Eleanor, can people purchase this one yet? Next year?
No, this is going to come out next year. And what I will say, so you asked about single varietals. You know, the great classic French wines from Bordeaux and also from the Rhone, and Neil should talk about this more than I do, are blended wines.
Mm-hmm.
And apples, of course, have even quite a bit less complexity than grapes. So when you want to get a complexity of flavor, which really means that it's firing as many of your taste buds around your mouth as possible, the more varieties that you can add that touch those different taste bud points, the more complex the flavor will be. So we have 11 different varieties in this Cavil blend that we're going to taste right
of
now.
Of apple. Okay, mm-hmm. That range from a sour and a sweet and a bitter So it's still those five tastes, though, right? Mother Nature gave us those five tastes.
Well, there's no salt in here, I'll tell you that.
Right. Oh, yeah. right. There's no salt. That's
and
right.
I don't know about umami in apples, but it could be. I just don't know.
Well, maybe. And Neil, would you define, I think most of our listeners may know what umami is, but just in case they
don't know what it is.
Of course you know what umami is.
Well, I think
umami.
It's
the fifth
savory.
Taste.
It's savory. And it's sort of related to monosodium glutamate.
Right.
I think it's salt related. So
yeah.
I would think perhaps this doesn't have
salt on steroids.
Yeah, not a term I was familiar with.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not familiar with umami.
No.
So, folks, we're now tasting 11 varieties of apples. And all of these were pressed individually, or these were pressed for this? These are all individually pressed.
And then blended.
Yeah. So there's a real art to the blending. Kind of like a scotch.
I should say we're not master blenders. My husband and I, we don't have background in this. We have help from an enologist in Montreal who works with ice cider makers. So that's.
But your first vintage was
really terrific.
Just you guys, isn't it? Did you have some help there?
We just had somebody at the end sort of helping us put it together at the end.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's almost like a little, but you know, you get to one stage, I think, and then a little bit of knowledge then takes you to another stage of where you start to question what you're doing and is this going to be the best blend? Is this, you know, the
and
first
then you know what you want
like
to tweak.
It's just mind blowing to me.
Yeah.
And then the next one, I can see the process that Eleanor is going through now. They're searching out and trying to figure out other ways to do things, you know?
Well, and the goal
other
is
options.
The goal is to have a variety of even ice cider
different products
right?
All
ice cider.
Yeah,
but
I don't
want
to get too complicated for folks. So we'll have our Eden brand, which is what we're tasting right now with the 11 different varieties
in it. Which does taste complex, more complex than the single note Honeycrisp.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Really lovely.
It's a little bit denser.
It is.
Has a little bit more residual sugar, I think. It lingers a little longer for me.
Right, it has a little more end. You were talking about your beginning, your middle, your end.
Yeah, it has a little more tartness as well,
right.
I think, than the other one.
Right.
But, you know, there's certain ones, it's the same as wine for me. There's certain wines that people drink, which are like jammy wines, like Zinfandel, this is not a general statement, but people go for a more bolder flavor as a drinking wine.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more kind of terroir, soil-driven wines that, to me, are the more complex, more nuances in flavors, and a little bit harder to work with. But
in terms of pairing, to me, they're
meant to be with food. You know, there's a process here. Like this one, both of them will be good with food.
And we should try some
cheese.
Yeah, and
you know, not only in the dessert mode. Having a sweet item with this, but to me, pairing this with cheese is just a fabulous.
So let's try that before we go, because we did mention that you could get to Anne Saxelby in New York and taste some of her, some of these great Vermont cheeses. Eleanor, what did you bring for us today?
Well, I brought two cheeses. Mm-hmm. I brought Vermont Dandy, which is a cave-aged sheep cheese. I have neighbors who have made a wonderful sheep cheese, but they have retired from the sheep cheese business.
Oh, too bad.
So I'm happy to have found Vermont Dandy, which is from Peak Mountain Sheep Dairy in Townsend, Vermont.
Okay.
Sheep cheeses, you know, sheep's milk has more butterfat than most than goat's milk or cow's milk, and the cheese often has a very nice nutty flavor, which complements the ice cider quite well.
And so folks may know a pecorino, right, an Italian pecorino. Would that be a similar type of aged sheep's milk cheese?
Yep.
So we're going to try some of that. And, yes, you may try this at home, everyone. This is not one of those things you have to be afraid.
In fact, it's a really fun thing to do with your friends on a Friday night or Saturday night. It's just get a bunch of cheeses from Ann's Shop or Murray's Cheese and find some ciders or ice ciders and try them individually and then try them with the different cheeses and figure out which cheese you like best with which cider. It's just a great
fun thing to do.
So
we're going
to
have a try. And we'll do the same thing that Neil did. We'll smell it first. Very nutty.
Mm-hmm.
Really nutty aroma. And if you wonder, if you're listening and you wonder, if you don't live in Vermont, where you can find Eden Ice Cider, their website is edenicecider.com, all spelled out. And on the site, you can find how to get the cider. There's some places where it's distributed, some places where you may have to get it through the mail, but you'll definitely be able to find it, and now is certainly the time to be thinking about getting it if you want to enjoy it. It'd be perfect for the holidays.
It's a perfect gift if you're sending stuff out of state or something.
This is great.
I do give away a lot of this at the restaurant, actually. Quote, give it away, because I think it's important that people get the opportunity to try this.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still so many people who are not aware of this product.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been featuring it, like I say, for 2 years at the restaurant, ever since it first came out. And
right.
We'll continue to feature it. It's just an amazingly delicious local product. But like I say, there's still a lot of people who are not
familiar with it yet.
Yeah,
and that's why we're hoping to tell them about it today.
I have not had anyone disappointed with it. I really haven't.
And the packaging's beautiful, too,
yeah,
so but nobody
simple.
Can see that yet.
Good
if you do have a copy of Edible Green Mountains from the fall, you can read about this in there also. But one thing I noticed is because the salt, there's a little salt in the cheese, you really get the full complement of flavors that with the ice cider. So we only have a few minutes left. Do you want us to try this other cheese? Is aged at Jasper Cellars.
This is the Cabot cloth-bound cheddar, which I know you can get in many places.
Yes.
And it's absolutely fabulous English style, as it's called, cloth-bound cheddar.
Right.
Apples and cheddar have been a classic combination for, I'm sure, centuries.
Right.
And it just goes, it's my favorite combination.
The cheddar with the ice cider. Right. And it is, you know, it's funny when we think about the fact that folks in New England eat their apple pie often with a slice of cheddar.
Right.
And so it is for us around
and
here really
called
close
out,
to turn.
It's the sweetness and the saltiness
that really comes together.
It's so great.
It's great.
So
we're going to have a little taste. This is a lot more crumbly than completely different aroma. You can really sort of smell the earth in this one in a good way. And so this is an aged cheddar, and like we said, I know Anne carries this one, and it's aged at the Stellars at Jasper Hill.
Mm-hmm. Which are about 25 miles from where we make the ice cider.
So you're in a micro situation there. And we should quickly tell folks a little bit about the Eden Ice Cider, and the orchard is located not in Eden. Some folks may think, because there is an Eden, Vermont, they're located in West Charleston. But Eden, of course, I think most of our listeners know that there's a connection between the Garden of Eden and apples.
Right.
And that reference was used when Eleanor and Albert were naming their wonderful vineyard. So I think that's about the time we have for the show today. I want to thank my guest, Eleanor Legere, for being here, and Neil Johnston. Eleanor, of course, from Eden Ice Cider, and Neil from the Kitchen Table Bistro.
Thank you.
And you can find their websites, edenicecider.com and thekitchentablebistro.com. I'm Deborah Shapiro, host of the Edible Community Show here on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks again to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. And don't go away and stay tuned in to the network, because the next show is going to be Eat to the Beat at 7 p.m. And I think that's something you're going to want to do tonight.